Welcome to the Edu All-Stars Podcast.
Hi, guys, and welcome to the 72nd episode of Edu All-Stars. My name is Todd Nesloni, and you can find me on Twitter at TechNinjaTodd.
Yep. My name is Chris Kessler. You can find me on Twitter at IamKessler. And we just want to thank everyone for joining us this evening. We've got a great show coming up, and we really appreciate any kind of feedback or comments that you would like to leave about the show. We'll have that up on the webpage. You can also leave comments out on iTunes about the podcast in general.
And we would like to encourage everyone, as you listen to this week's episode, to tweet out using the hashtag EduAllStars. We love seeing the conversation and hearing about the things that stick out to you from all of our amazing guests. We are very thrilled to have the pleasure of getting to speak with Ms. Donalyn Miller tonight on Edu All Stars. Donalyn currently works for Scholastic as a manager of independent reading and outreach. And in addition to her countless years of work in the classroom, she is also the author of the books The Book Whisperer and Reading in the Wild. So Donalyn, thank you so much for coming on with us today.
And thank you for inviting me to be here. I'm really excited.
Well, the best place we always love to start with each of our guests is just kind of hearing a little bit about your background and how you got into education.
Well, my mom would say it started when I was four and used to take my Fisher-Price schoolhouse and force my little sisters to play school. I was always that nerdy little kid that asked the teacher for all the extra workbooks on the last day of school, and then I would bring them home and torment my sisters with math worksheets all summer. But I really started out as an adult in hotel and restaurant management, and then I was in accounting. And I went back to school to get my CPA in accounting, and I told my husband, I don't want to be an accountant. I want to be a teacher. And so he said, go be a teacher. And so I went back through, all the way through a teacher ed program, student taught with people who were younger than me, and really got a great learning experience. And then the day that I walked into my own classroom, I just knew that that was what I was supposed to have been doing. So my path took a little bit longer, but I think it was the experiences I had were worthy. They really prepared me a lot for being in the classroom. You know, in the business world, I always joke that it's kind of like Janet Jackson. What have you done for me lately is kind of the drive. And you're only as good as your last idea in the business world. And so that hunger to stay current, to be innovative, to be on the edge of learning, I guess I picked that up in the business world first.
So this is your first year out of the classroom. Talk a little bit about your new role with Scholastic.
Well, you know, I've been able to grassroots a lot of ideas over the past few years through Twitter, through my books, through the networks and communities that I've developed. But there's always that idea of that I'm not reaching enough people, that the message about the importance of reading, about giving kids choice, about empowering students could reach more people than it is. And so Scholastic has the ability to reach a lot of those people. I also, Scholastic has a lot of programs and things that they put in place for teachers, for librarians, for parents that I think are underutilized. And I also feel like sometimes they don't always have a teacher voice at the table when they're having these meetings and making these decisions. So now they do have a teacher voice at the table.
That's excellent. Let's jump right into your book. So when did you first decide that you wanted to write these books?
I'll let you know when that happened. Well, I don't know if you know that I was invited to write a column for EdWeek called Ask the Mentor. And that really started kind of strangely. My principal had worked with a lady who years before at a school in Oklahoma, and she became the editor of the EdWeek teacher magazine stuff. And she called him and said, do you have any teachers that could write this column? He said, well, I have one. So she called me and she said, let me get this right. Your kids read 50 books a year, and you don't give out prizes. You don't give out rewards. And I said, isn't reading its own reward? And she said, you're going to be a tough sell for the column, Donalyn. You don't have a PhD. You've never written a book, but we'll just see what happens. And I guess they were desperate because they took me. So the Ask the Mentor column was supposed to be one column. It turned into three columns, and they were the number two, three, and four highest rated pieces on EdWeek that year. sadly, number one that year was why teachers leave the classroom.
Oh, no.
So I was glad to be the next three. And when I finished, but before I finished that column, they said, hey, you want to blog for us? And I remember thinking, I don't know the first thing about blogging. I'll just fake it. I'll just do it, you know. So I told him, yes, I would do the blog. And then some publishers started contacting me, and they said, hey, do you want to write a book for us? And I said, no, I don't. I don't know the first thing about writing a book. And I remember a publisher, the publisher I eventually chose was Josie Bass, and their Wiley Josie Bass. And they flew out to Dallas to take my husband and me to dinner at one of the fanciest restaurants in Dallas. And we're driving in the car on the way over there, and I told my husband, I'm just going to tell him no. And my husband said, tell him after dinner.
Yeah. My wife would have said the same thing.
He said, tell him after dinner, because, you know, he's in healthcare, and I was a teacher, and we don't get to go to fancy restaurants, right? So they were so kind to me, and they said, you know, we understand you're unknown. We really believe in your ideas. And so I wrote the Book Whisperer for them, and I felt kind of this reckless bravery when I wrote that book, because I really honestly thought no one would read it. And I thought, you know, they're never going to ask me again to do this. So I need to say everything that I really believe, because if I don't say it now, I will probably never get that opportunity again. And I think that's what made the book what it was, is that I was kind of fearless, maybe recklessly, stupidly so, but I mean, I wouldn't take any of it back. But I think that's what makes the book as good as it is.
Well,
so that was a long answer.
That was a great story, because, you know, I think some of us that do things like speak or write or all these kind of things, people think that it's just naturally what you always wanted to do and that you were always been great at it. And it's great to hear that even from really successful people who've wrote great material like yourself, that you never thought that that was going to be a path for you.
No, I didn't.
So tell us a little, tell us and our listeners a little bit about the Book Whisperer and Reading in the Wild.
So the Book Whisperer really came from, my students really read a lot. They were very successful on standardized tests of reading achievement, which is not, of course, my basic drive, but people always want to know about that. And they read just mountains of books. They loved to read. We had a great reading community. The writing was great. And, you know, trying to unpack that and explain how it happened is what really the Book Whisperer is about, you know. And I wrote that over 6 months, every night going home and writing after school, and then coming back in and talking to my students about things, because sometimes we don't always know why what we're doing works. And it was interesting for me to unpack that for myself as I was writing the book. You know, what are the individual components that are making this work? With Reading in the Wild, it really came from, I still had questions. You know, it was really action research is what drove that book, because I would have kids who read a lot in my classroom in sixth grade, and then I would run into them at Target a year later, and they would walk towards me like I was the reading police. You know, hello, Mrs. Miller, I haven't read a book since I left your class. And it really irritated me, because I thought, what happened? You know, they were reading. Or they'd tell me they were reading Call of the Wild for 2 months. And I would say, well, how do you like Call of the Wild? And they would say, oh, we're not reading it. And yeah, exactly. And these were kids that read 50 books in sixth grade, you know, 45 mm-hmm. books. And I will admit, I'm not proud of it, but I promise I've evolved. But I used to blame the teachers I sent them to. I'm like, okay, you broke my kids. They were reading in my class. Now they're back to fake reading Call of the Wild. You know, how does that happen? But it occurred to me, if they were truly independent readers, why did they still need a teacher to orchestrate their reading lives? You know, why did they still need an adult to drive it for them? And so I created the Wild Reader Survey. I wanted to look at what are really the habits of lifelong readers that we're supposedly instilling in kids. Are we really? What was that missing piece between my students who only read if I orchestrated those conditions in the classroom, and then that bridge to the outside school to make them readers? And so I interviewed 948 adult readers about their reading habits and asked them how they were keeping a reading life going when they no longer had school constraints, and then that informed Reading in the Wild. So
So how do you motivate those unmotivated readers or unmotivated children? Just, I'm not a reader. I hate reading. What do you do to motivate them?
Wait. Are you saying you don't like reading? Because we could work on you right now while we're on the
phone. Okay, let's pretend that I'm not a reader, but I am. I do like reading, however. But I'm a science teacher, and I see lots of my students reading books in their spare time, you know, after a test or whatever. And then other kids that don't want any part of that, even if they're given free time to read. So how do I get those kids to get interested?
Well, I think in any discipline, in any endeavor, passion drives effort. I don't care what it is. And so if we really want kids to put effort into reading, we have to show them something passionate about it. I think we, and when I say we, I always mean me because I'm still growing as a teacher. But this idea that if we want kids to read, we have to value all the things they want to read. There's a big debate this fall. A woman wrote an article in the New Yorker about how she was unhappy her son was reading Percy Jackson. And I think, you know, we complain that kids don't read, then we bemoan their choices when they do. You know, it's not that we want them to read, but we want them reading Tom Sawyer in the sixth grade. You know, and that turns a lot of kids off reading. We don't value all the different things they might want to read. Engagement, to me, is the key. We have to make reading relevant for kids. We have to give them things that are engaging to read. We have to give them choices. And for some kids, you know, kids will take all the choices we give them. But sometimes the only choice we give them is to just refuse to engage. You know, and so if we take all their reading choices away, then the only choice they have left is to refuse to engage.
Now, how long did you teach before you went in to work with Scholastic this year? How many years?
13. 13 years.
So when did this realization come to you that this was the kind of way that you needed to be teaching? Because I think about this, and, you know, I think that when I see some reading teachers, or especially some new teachers, it's like, no, they got to read on their level, and they have to read this novel, and we have to get through these things because that's the way it's been done. And, you know, what you're saying is what some of us who try to do things differently still believe, but it's so unlike the norm. So when did that realization come to you that that's what kids needed to be doing?
Well, I mean, it didn't happen overnight, but I think the first dime that dropped for me was the first fall I taught, because I was doing reading logs. Everybody in my department did reading logs. They were grading the reading logs. We were chasing kids down for the reading logs. And I'm sitting there with a stack of reading logs one Friday, grading them and putting them in the grade book, and I realized I was missing the same logs I was always missing from the same kids. And the logs I did have were signed in the same parent handwriting in the same color ink Monday through Friday.
Right.
And this wave came over me, and I thought, what am I really grading here? I'm grading mom and dad's ability to find a pen in the car on Fridays. You know, it's not really any evidence the kids are actually reading. So what was I going to do about that? That was the first piece. And then the second piece was I had designed, and I talk about this in the book Whisper, I designed this beautiful unit on The View from Saturday, a Newbery-winning book that I had loved. It was, you know, one of those Ark of the Covenant novel units that we spent 2 months designing. My kids hated the book. Hated it. They hated me. They hated all the activities. And I was heartbroken because I thought the book was so awesome. And I thought I probably did more that year to make kids hate that book than I ever made them love it. So some of those slow moments that first year I taught, and I thought, okay, this isn't what reading means to me at all. Mm-hmm. So what's the disconnect here? What's the missing piece? I think it really saved me as a teacher that I was a reader, because I could see there was a piece missing there between what reading really should be for people and what it was to my kids.
So, I mean, in your books and some of the things you talk about is using a workshop model to work with kids. How do we convince teachers at schools who may already have these great high-performing scores on standardized test scores, and they're doing things like the passages and the answers, and I know you're in Texas, and so I'm in Texas as well, so I'm thinking about the way our standardized tests work here. How do you convince those teachers that giving this choice and teaching through a workshop model is really the kind of way that is preferable and best for kids?
Well, I think we have to ask ourselves We have to be honest with ourselves about what our real goal is for our kids. Because if our real goal for our kids is independent, literate, enriching lives, then we have to have the reality check that test prep is not going to get them there. If we think, and you know, we would like to think that everyone wants their kids to be lifelong learners, but for so many teachers, the end goal is just that test at the end of the year. Mm-hmm. And we've got to get past that. You know, right. That's somebody else's goal for our kids. That's a politician's goal for our kids. That's not our goal. Shouldn't be our goal. Our real contract isn't a political one. It's a social one. We as teachers have taken on a social charge to send engaged, informed, enthusiastic, participatory citizens out in the world. And if we can have that conversation with ourselves, then we have to admit that test prep isn't going to get us there. But yeah. I think success breeds success, too. You've got to have somebody trying it. Somebody, you can usually convince one. You can't convince a whole staff, I think, at a time. Y'all know this from your own work. If you can get one person to do it, other people get curious.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Sure. So the flip side of that is, let's say you have a new teacher to the workshop, and what advice would you give that person that does not see those boost in standardized scores or did not see any impact in, you know, negligible scores that the schools do care about?
I would probably want to talk to that person about their – well, I would, because I would say, you know, did we compromise our way into some kind of distortion of that model in order to kind of find some balance? Because I can't imagine a scenario where kids who read more score worse on standardized tests of reading. I mean, the research just shows us the complete opposite. The kids who read the most are always going to outperform kids who don't read that much. Now, that does not mean we're not still teaching reading. You know, it's just like we've got to look at that independent practice and independent writing practice in the same way that we look at other kinds of practice. You know, practice doesn't make perfect. It makes permanent. You know, no one goes into the band hall and asks the band director why the kids are just playing their clarinets in there. No one goes down to the basketball coach and says, you know, these kids really should be doing a Venn diagram comparing basketball to baseball instead of dribbling a basketball. But when we have kids just reading, and I'll do the air quotes, just reading or just writing in English class, it seems aberrant somehow. And that just baffles me. How are kids going to get better at reading if they don't read very much?
Right. Well, I have a question that's more, I guess, personal to my heart and my situation with where I'm working right now. And that is, you know, I work in a district. I just moved recently as an administrator into a district that is struggling in several factors, but the biggest is reading. And knowing that coming into my campus, the first thing we did was spend the first 10 weeks building a love of reading. And you know, my librarian, Kathy French, who's brand new to being a librarian, has done an incredible job of inspiring kids and getting them to read. And we've done a concerted effort as a staff to have that be our focus. And we're now at a point where we're not fighting kids to read. Mm-hmm. But the issue that we deal with is we have classrooms where 75% of our students are reading two or three grade levels below where they should be.
Yep.
So what do you even do as a teacher in that situation when you know I'm teaching a fifth grader right now, and 10 and 11 years old, and I want them reading these great things, but they're reading on a first grade, second grade level, and it's 75% of them, and I have to get them where I need them to be kind of thing?
Well, we can't just get them to leap up a mountain. You right. know, it's so... And you know that. So we do have those grade level standards. I think we're still doing direct instruction, you know, in the ways that we teach reading. We want kids to learn academic vocabulary. You know, the first time they see those words shouldn't be on a test passage. They should have them cold. What we find a lot looking at tests of reading, it's not that the kids don't understand the answers. Sometimes they don't understand the question. Like what it's even asking them to do. And I would also, there's a big discussion that could be had about academic vocabulary and having kids see the connections between academic vocabulary terms that are synonymous in different disciplines. So, for example, making a prediction in reading, making a hypothesis in science, and making an estimation in math, that's the same thinking. but the kids don't see it that way. You know, they compartmentalize that. So there's some teaching of that vocabulary that could probably be helpful to them. Even if they are reading below grade level, they can still get those pieces. The other piece is they've got to have things they can actually read. You know, Richard Allington says you can dump out the desk of a struggling reader and they probably can't read 80% of what is in that desk. Their textbooks, the books that they're reading. Now, the issue with fifth graders, and you know, I taught fifth grade last year. I had everything from a little boy who knew one word of English, the word teacher, which, you know, somebody taught him before he came to my class, all the way up to kids who are reading a couple years above grade level, and I bet you have the same mix at your school. So it's not that the fifth graders don't want to read those first grade and second grade books. They don't want to be seen reading them. Mm-hmm. That's an issue, too. They don't want to be the fifth grader reading Ramona.
And that's pretty funny that you bring that up, because that was the question that my librarian, Kathy, had asked. She was like, can you please ask her, how can we teach fourth and fifth graders to read without being embarrassed and to still keep their dignity intact, because they're so embarrassed to say, I like reading, but I can only read this, and I don't want you to make fun of me for that.
Well, there's two things. They're both tech reasons, which might intrigue you, because I know that you enjoy those opportunities for kids as much as I do. But one thing we can do is provide them scaffolds to get to the piece that they want to read. So we know listening to the audio while they read a book can actually help them read up above where they are independently. They've got to have both. They can't just listen to the audio. They have to have the book in front of them. It's great support for kids who are English language learners, because they're hearing the words pronounced in context while they're seeing them on the page. The fluency is faster. You know, it kind of ups their game a little bit with the fluency. And they can read a little closer to grade level than what they could on their own. The other thing we can do is get them Kindles. Get them Kindle apps on iPads. Kids can hide what they're reading on a Kindle, too.
Right.
You know, just for different reasons than we do. But they can, you know. What I found was I took my old Kindle keyboard, the stripped down one. When I got my Kindle Fire, I don't even use my Kindle now. I use my iPad. But when I got my Kindle keyboard, my Kindle Fire, I took my old Kindle keyboard down to school and threw it in a drawer, because the status of having the class Kindle kind of offset the hit the kids took about what they were reading. The friends couldn't see what they were reading. So they didn't know. They were just, hey, Daniel got the Kindle today. You know, that was the cool piece of it. So there's some workarounds there. They need a lot of practice in what they can actually read.
Yeah, it's great ideas. So thinking back when you were in the classroom, what are some of the favorite lessons that you had, or maybe even like a favorite unit that you like to teach?
Well, I did the one that my sixth graders really loved that kind of surprised me, because it was one of those units. Isn't this how this happens? A unit that could have been a complete, you knew it was either going to be a hot mess or it was going to be fabulous. And you weren't really sure which way it was going to go, but you just decided to lean into the curve. So my students were all over Greek mythology that year, and I was also teaching sixth grade world cultures. So learning about all the countries of the world. And that was a year when this businessman in Europe was trying to reimagine the world wonders of the, you know, the ancient world wonders that we had, like the Colossus in Rome, the pyramids of Giza. He was trying to get new monuments chosen as the world wonders, and he had this whole contest online. So my students and I read about classical Greek mythology and classical Greek architecture, but we also studied landmarks from all over the world. And then the kids picked, I just let them pick whatever they wanted, we looked at World Heritage sites online and looked at Google Earth and really went in and looked at some of these sites. And then they picked landmarks that they felt should be modern world wonders. They had to do a pitch presentation to the class, and then we had to vote on who our world wonders were going to be. That was very successful. The kids loved it.
Cool.
1 year we took the 100 times 100 most influential people of the 20th century, and the kids picked different people from that issue of the Time magazine, and then we did almost like a March Madness brackets with it. So like Gandhi and Margaret Thatcher went head to head, you know, and they had to do Oprah. I remember one of my big tall guys, Adam, picked Oprah Winfrey as his person. And he gave the most impassioned speeches about why he thought Oprah Winfrey was the most influential person. So the kids just did brackets and voted, and we had a huge bracket all the way down the wall in our hallway, where and the kids would go out there every day to see who was coming up next in the rankings. But that was a lot of fun, too.
That's awesome.
What about something you're reading right now? What genre do you like to read?
Well, I read a lot of children's literature. I read a lot of young adult literature because mm-hmm. I am asked to recommend it a lot, and I also enjoy it. You know, adult books, I should say books published for adults, because adult books sound like it could be something else, but books published for adults, I'm reading right now the Pulitzer a few years back called The Emperor of Maladies, and it's about cancer, but it's about the history of cancer over human history. So books for adults, I like to read like Bill Bryson, a lot of nonfiction books, especially books that like pair science and history together. Like Jim Murphy wrote a great book on tuberculosis that looked at the science of the disease, but also the history of tuberculosis throughout human history. I'm working on a new book. So it's about engagement, and so going back and rereading all of John Guthrie's research on reading engagement, looking at, again, rereading, I just reread Alfie Cohn's Punished by Rewards again, so I've always got two or three things going, usually a children's book, an adult book, and something for research at the same time.
It's rare that a guest on our show actually mentions something that I've actually read. I have read a Bill Bryson book. I read the Into the Woods, which is fantastic. I love that one.
Did you read his short history of nearly everything in the universe?
I have it, but I have not read it. I own it.
As a science teacher, you'd probably really love it.
Yeah, my mom gave me that for, I think it was for Christmas last year, and of course it sits here right on my bookshelf, not open yet.
You can always get the audio. Do you have a long drive to school?
I got the really short history of nearly everything. I've got like the shortened version, like the easy version to read. Like it was like lots of pictures and stuff. And I still haven't even gotten through that one. So.
Oh, man. Well, Donalyn, what is something that you're probably most proud of accomplishing?
Professionally?
Anything.
Well, my kids would probably be number one. My oldest daughter just turned 25, and she's a Montessori preschool teacher. She struggled all the way through school with dyslexia, and she says, "Mom, reading is still really hard for me, but I can read picture books to three-year-olds." And she said, I can still be a really great preschool teacher. And she's a great mom, so we have two granddaughters now. They love to read, and they hang out. They were just over at the house today. So my family, of course, would be what I'm most proud of. But I think all I can think of is all the kids I've taught, and you know, the kids who were in the Book Whisperer just graduated from high school this spring, and I went to a high school. I'm sure I had nothing to do with this, but they were really great kids. But at their high school graduation, six of the kids who were in the top 10 at the high school were kids that I had taught in sixth grade.
Very cool.
And I went to one girl's high school graduation, Daniela. She was in the Book Whisperer. Her little sister, Sabrina, was in Reading in the Wild. And, you know, when you're kind of at the middle of kids' journey as a teacher, you kind of wonder if they're even going to really remember that much about you. And I walked into Daniela's graduation party, and all these six-foot-tall boys came up to me, "Mrs. Miller," and told me all about going to college. And then they wanted to tell me about the books they were all reading, I guess. I am still kind of the reading police, but
aren't all ELA teachers?
That's okay. I'll own it. I'll take it.
That's right. You gotta just own it. So what happens like when you're having a really hard day? You had a really tough day at school, like, or even in your job now. What do you do to recenter yourself?
Well, I think it's important for us to have networks and communities of support. And you know, over the years, I mean, I've always worked at a school with great teachers, but sometimes you just have to get away from your own school community and feed yourself, too. And I think the more experience you have as a teacher, the less that kind of campus-based PD can feed you. It's not targeted enough to your individual interests and needs. So Twitter's been huge for me. Just even clarity of going for a walk, sitting somewhere and reading a book, but I also think professionally you have to rejuvenate yourself professionally by talking to other people, other colleagues, maybe not at your school, people who are asking some of the same questions that you do.
Sure. I completely agree. And you know, it's funny, that's what we talk about quite a lot, Chris and I, about just being connected with others and how it was like social media for me kind of saved my career in a sense because it made me see that there were others out there who thought like me or wanted to change things like I did, and I wasn't limited by I have to wait for my district to send me.
Yeah.
So I have to, the only people I know in education are who are at my school. And so what's been the biggest thing that you've learned in the last year?
I don't know. Gosh, that's a bit, like, I've learned something new just basically every day. One thing that I learned is that bringing new people to the watering hole is important, but it's also important to validate and feed the people who are already there.
Ooh.
You know, I mean, that sounds like a no-brainer when I say it, but so often I found when you move into a leadership role in teaching, you kind of view it the same way you did the kids in your class. You know, we put a lot of effort into the kids who are not on board to get them on board. But when you move into more of a leadership role with adults, you have to recognize that, yes, we need to get people on board, help them learn, you know, remove obstacles that might be impediments to learning. But we also have to feed the rabbits, you know, because those people are already driving themselves. They're already hungry. They're already willing to jump in. But they can get burned out really easy if we don't continue to validate and feed them. So I think that's one thing as a leader I've learned as I move more into a role where I'm working more with adults.
Yeah, so I think that's fantastic advice.
I think it's something that's one of those obvious pieces, but it's easily forgotten.
Yep.
Because even when you're saying it now, and me in my administrator role, I'm thinking about sometimes the people that I spend the most time with on campus or those who I'm trying to get somewhere. And I tend to forget about those people who are killing it because they're killing it. But they need my attention too, and that's the same way I needed to be in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And you're right, it totally applies the same in an administrative role as well.
Yep.
Yeah. What about like biggest challenges in your current job? What are some things that challenge you?
Well, one thing that really just continually surprises me is the lack of basic pedagogical knowledge about the processes of reading, the processes of learning, I mean, the information's there. I probably get a tweet every day, and I'm not exaggerating, a tweet or a Facebook message or an email every day from someone that says, do you have research to support the importance of independent reading? I mean, and all I tell myself is, you know what, Donalyn, the world still needs you today. I mean, but my friend Terry Lassane and I actually started a chat this summer because we called the BP Roots chat, Best Practices Roots. I'm not trying to plug the chat, but I'm just saying the whole purpose of the chat was just to kind of put back out there for people some of that research that's been out for literally forever. And I think parents don't understand it, and we're not, and that means we're not communicating it to them in a way that they can understand it. Administrators don't always understand it, and it's not their fault. You know, we're asking administrators now to be instructional leaders in every discipline with very little preparation about that. You know, I had a great principal who was a fantastic junior high math teacher. She was a great leader. She was a great administrator. But she came to me and said, what should I be looking for in a language arts classroom? I don't even know. If I walk in a room for 10 minutes, what should I be looking for? So sharing that basic, even just foundational knowledge, I find is key. And, you know, with Scholastic now, I'm working with people who are not educators, many of them. And so just having some of those same conversations.
Well, Donalyn, one of the questions that we always like to end on when we do an Edu All-Stars episode is asking our guest, what is something that you are really passionate about right now?
Engagement, engagement, engagement. And I mean engagement in meaningful ways. I see that engagement has become one of those buzzwords that is getting corrupted in education. I actually saw, not kidding, a checklist for a principal that was an engagement, one of the pieces under engagement said, are all the kids sitting compliantly with their eyes on the teacher. And they were rating them on engagement based on that measure. And you're laughing wow. because you know it's probably true. And then and then I see the pendulum go completely the other way, where people think if you just attach an iPad to something, the kids are instantly engaged. It's like we're not looking at the underpinning of what engagement really is. What is that iPad offering the learner that is making them engaged? To me, that's the more intriguing question. So.
Yeah, I am laughing because it is true. Like, and I will fail that one every single time.
Yeah, my kids, it looks like an ant colony if you walk in my classroom.
I know, I always worry about that. Anyone that stops by to pass out something to me or whatever, it's like zoo in my class. Like, you know, kids are all over the place. So anyway.
Oh, no, the last 10 years I taught, my room was at the end of the school, at the end of the hallway. So no one just dropped by, and I was grateful.
Well, Donna, thank you so much for spending some time with us this evening. We truly, truly appreciate it. How can our listeners connect with you if they'd like to?
Well, I'm very active on Twitter, as you know, so my Twitter ID is @DonnaLynnBooks. I have my website at bookwhisperer.com. I have my Facebook page for the Book Whisperer. I'm also on Goodreads, which is a social networking site for readers. So all different ways people can access my thinking and my reading, and I can connect with them too.
Awesome. And then ways you can connect with us, we're on Twitter at EduAllStarsHQ. You can find us on the website, eduallstars.com. And then on iTunes, you can search out EduAllStars with no spaces and find all the previous 71 episodes there.
Mm-hmm. And join us next Sunday at 8 p.m. Central Standard Time, November 16th, as we interview the Fab Explorer Lab teacher, Emily Swenson from Louisiana. Thank you again, Donnalyn, so much for coming on. We really appreciate you giving us some of your time. We know how busy you are, but this was wonderful.
Oh, no, thank you. I had a good time. Thank you so much, gentlemen, and congratulations on this effort. It's really wonderful.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.